I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. This is the Rugby Dungeon. I'm JB, and today I am joined by Blair Cowan. Blair, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's okay, mate. It's okay. What have you been up to today?
Just the usual second day of training. Uh-huh. Then back home and change some diapers. And try and get a little one down. That's as rock and roll as I'm getting at the moment.
Oh, mate, tell me about it. How old's yours?
2 months is my first.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. So yeah. That's really serious then.
Yeah, yeah. Whole new lifestyle really in the last 2 months, and sort of shooting from the hip with the majority of it, especially with lockdown and parents not being able to come around. But loving every minute of it.
Are your parents in London then?
No, they're in New Zealand, but they would have always come over, especially for
of course,
the first
yeah.
few months, 100%. But New Zealand's so strict on coming back into the country, there's just no possible way it was happening. So the same with Rachel's parents, they're back home as well. So not ideal situation, but we're just rolling with the punches, as is everyone, and cracking on as.
Yeah.
Pretty eye-opening, really.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I just wrestled to bed a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and then I went for a quick kettlebell workout, and then I'm here. I've got to maximise every second of time that I possibly can.
I was wondering why you're still rocking the wife beater.
Yeah, in like mid-March. It's good luck.
Yeah.
So you guys have got Bath on the weekend. What kind of fixture is it? Is that for you? Because obviously there's a bit of a rivalry there, as they've got most of your old players.
Yeah, considering that they're so far away from London, it has developed into a bit of a rivalry or sort of a clash. And I think it's just, yeah, like you say, it has developed just through a lot of our academy sort of being snapped up there once they've progressed. And a lot of those boys are regulars in the international setup, but they seem to enjoy taking the cream of our crop, and it's definitely not penciled in as that sort of that rivalry match, but this seems to be a centre there around the club these days.
Tell me this: were you not linked very heavily with Bath once? I thought you nearly signed there.
Yeah, there's the rumour mill was strong, and. I remember it was our first relegation or second relegation, and that rumour started flying around Twitter. There's no substance to it whatsoever. Hadn't even spoken to Bath. And I remember it was in the rugby paper at one stage saying that it was basically signed and sealed. And I remember getting someone tagging me on Twitter, one of the supporters, saying, does anyone want to buy my Blair Cowan jersey that I bought on an auction.
He's
leaving us, and I was like, oh, wow, yeah. Although this is how fast it spread. Absolutely no substance to it whatsoever, and I was obviously stayed here, but yeah, that's a classic case of the rumour mill.
But, of course, the real truth to that story was you were too busy thinking about going on loan to win a European Cup.
Yeah, that literally happened in a day. Never heard anything of it, and then in 24 hours I was up in Saracens.
Yeah, what was that story? What's your link to Saracens? Did you know someone there before the whole thing came about?
It's kind of a long, complicated story, but I'll wrap it up fairly short. I was playing for London Irish and starting most weeks, and my granddad fell ill, and it was the coach, Brendan Venter, at the time.
Yeah.
And obviously Brendan Venter's heavily, he was sort of the DOR. Well, Kendo was the DOR, but Brendan Venter was overseeing the whole operation. And I mean, I really like Brendan Venter, but he's got a very old school sort of style, like, you know, and
yeah,
what say sort of goes sort of thing. So I asked the club, my granddad fell ill, and I asked the club if I could go home and say my goodbyes, and they were nice enough to give me sort of 10 days. And at the time, we were quite heavily stacked with sevens.
Mm.
We had Connor Gilson, Jake Schatz, Noggers, Max, Northcote Green. And then we had a couple of like six sevens and eight sevens. And then obviously myself, and I went to New Zealand and I come back and, you know, I was in the gym. I remember I was with Jimmy Marshall. We were in the gym and Brendan Venter asked if I could come outside. And to be fair, Gills and Shatsy and Max had played well while I was gone.
Yeah.
And I knew I wouldn't walk straight in the mix from being away, but, BV pulled me out, Brendan Venter pulled me out, and he goes, I thought he was going to say, look, you're not going to play this weekend. But he said, oh, look, you know, these boys have played really well, and, you know, you're probably about third or fourth string at the moment. And I was like, oh, I didn't know it was that bad. How long was I gone for? You know, I thought it was 10 days. But he goes, but we want you to get game time. So how do you feel about going to Saracens? And I was like,
what a bizarre conversation.
Yeah, this is, and I'm like 2 days still jet lagged and stuff from New Zealand. And I kept shaking my head. I was like, huh? Did I hear that correctly? And he was like, yeah. Look, this is a really unique situation. Obviously, you know, I know Mark McCall quite well. They need a player of your caliber. It'll be strictly on a we say when you can come back basis, but you know, it's ideal for everyone. Obviously the club might have got a bit of money for it, and I would have got some game time, but we were in relegation battle at this period, you know, like, and was I involved with Scotland at that stage? I can't remember, but you know, the supposed you know, been at the club a long time and just seemed to be leaving when times were tough and the relegation battle. I said, I don't feel real comfortable about this.
Oh God, yeah, not even thought about that.
Yeah, I was just like, you know, this is quite a tough one because I don't want the boys to think I'm jumping ship here. Mm. He goes, no, you go, it's in the best interest for both the club, yourself, and the boys, give you some game time, and at any stage we want you back, we bring you back. So, you know, at that point I was like, okay. And to be fair, I did look at it as I'd been at the club for 5 or 6 years by this time, and I thought this is a great sort of just personal development and go and experience some successful European winning club and go experience that and maybe bring something back. But that was the sort of the short end of it. And it was a pretty wild ride when I went up there as well.
That's incredible. Now, you're obviously a London Irish guy. You've been there for a long time, so there's no doubting how much you must like the club to be there for that long. But what was the contrast like from going from a relegation battler to a European Cup likely, well, eventually a European Cup winner?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was awesome, and they were really welcoming, and I learned a lot, and they were all great blokes up there. I mean, I think if you had to go to any team, even if they're your rival team or whatever, I'm sure you go there and you realise they're actually a great bunch of guys. And certainly my experience of Saracens, and I didn't know what to expect really, but then I learned quite fast. What they've developed there took time, and it took patience and structure and obviously financial comfort with their owners. But it's definitely, it's not happened overnight, and you could see that from going there. And that gave me sort of, that inspired me a bit when I come back to Irish. It's like, okay, I've got an idea. It does take a period, and it's all about keeping the same group of boys, especially the academy,
yes,
and developing that culture and making sure that it's solid and that you've got the foundations, because as you've seen, there's teams that do well 1 year, and if the foundations aren't there, I mean, this isn't, I have no idea about the Newcastle sort of environment, but 1 year they're in the premiership semi-finals, and then they get relegated the following year. So it's really, it's a slow process of developing a team and a like an environment that's going to have longevity to get to that success. And yeah. I seen that at the club. I'd seen what they had built and the way that I literally got there within 1 week. I knew their plays. I knew how they played. I knew what they were looking for. I knew where to be because everyone was so in tune that it was very easy for me to see,
I see
what was going on. So it was really interesting. It was really awesome. It was really good to see the culture side. And I really enjoyed Mark McCaw. I really got on really well with Alex as well. And to see him go to Sale, I think he's going to do great things up there as well.
Hopefully. But I think you're absolutely right when you say it takes time because, you know, obviously the whole Eddie Jones thing is in the news at the moment and it sounds like he might be under pressure. He might not be under pressure. No one really knows. But I guess one of the people who'll be considered for that role, if it ever comes available in England, will be one of the Saracens lads, whether it be Mark McCall or Alex Sanderson or Borthwick or, you know, whoever it is. And I think you're right in what you say. It takes time. And because it takes time, I do wonder if they'll be the right individuals to do it. Because if it takes time at international level, it might be quite a tricky appointment, that. Because I just think the club game is so much different from the international game.
I think international is, it's a whole different ball game. I think there is going to be a period. But every coach, as Eddie did, as majority of coaches that come in, normally when either an international side or a club is, say, struggling, a coach has this thing we call the shelf life, you know? And
yeah.
They come in and have this impact, and it'll be either the fear of the new coach, it'll be the shake-up, you know? So when they arrive, everyone just all of a sudden starts performing a bit better, being training better, because this coach is going to bring this uncertainty and you yourself are uncertain of your future because whether he likes you or not. So you've got to perform. You've got to you've got to sort of please him in a certain way and get a feel for him without sort of messing up. And
yeah.
I think Eddie certainly had that. Everyone had that fear factor when he turned up. But whether that shelf life's coming to an end, which the results seem to show, you know, sort of a Rob Baxter or a Mark McCall.
Yeah.
If you could get a bit of a longer shelf life out of the international scene and maybe breathe blood in some new, fresh players that are going to have longer futures in the national scene, I mean, that's also exciting, and it'll be interesting to see what path or how they would go about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. How do you deal with a new coach? Because at London Irish alone, I'm just thinking now, Tom Coventry, Nick Kennedy, Declan Kidney, you must have had a few others on top of that as well. How do you deal with new coaches as a player and as a senior player now? Because I guess it's down to you to impress them or make an impression or something.
It's probably a bit different for me now, as I'm in my twilight years, they'd say. I would, you know, I probably can speak to them more on a level, you know. I probably have less to worry about as far as my future because, you know, I got 2-3 years left of the best, and I'm confident in knowing the game and knowing myself. But as a youngster, for sure, when you've got a new coach or you turn up to a new environment and trying to put your foot forward, you know, there's always that bit of fear, and sometimes that can be a bad thing in performance. Sometimes it can be a good thing in performance, depending on how you thrive in those moments. But every coach is different as well. Some coaches make it easier, some coaches make it harder, depending on their style, whether the old school sort of hard dictatorship kind of coaches, or if they're the really open, want to develop you as a player sort of person, you know. I've never had like a coach I didn't like as a person. I might disagree with certain things, but I think they all mean well. And it's just, I suppose it's just trying to find out what they want from you.
Yeah.
What do you want from me on the field? And I'll do my best to sort of supply that. Because at the end of the day, you do sort of have to conform to what they want, as it's going to be the new team sort of way they're playing. And they can also have an effect on yourself individually because it might be so far from, you know, what you bring.
Yeah. Now, just on, you know, how teams interact with coaches and actually how teams interact with each other as well. How old are you now, Blair? 34. Okay. So, I mean, you'll be well aware that you go from being sort of a senior player to quite old in rugby pretty quickly. And before you know it, you're like the oldest in the changing room. But London Irish is a little bit different because you seem to have assembled a load of guys who are in their 30s and a little bit more. Well, they've got a lot of rugby underneath their belts. How is that for you? Because you could have been in a changing room which is just full of young kids, but actually you're in a changing room full of old chargers and ultra professional guys.
I mean, the game's progressed certainly. You know, these guys who are sort of in the older ages, you still have to. Back in the day, you could probably just turn up to Saturday. You know, you could probably eat what you wanted, but the old guys knew their role, knew how to sort of get through an 80 minutes and crack on, and then they just manage themselves during the week, and you sort of roll the roof. You know, you rule the roost when it comes to that.
Yeah.
But these days, you know, these guys are looking after their bodies fairly well. There's a few battered guys, and they carry a few knocks and bruises, but they're so, you're in such a professional area. Like, I can honestly say, this is the best I've ever felt in probably the last 5 years. And that's just from knowing my body, and it certainly doesn't. I think that balance as well with old boys and young boys, and then having those guys in the middle is key. And I suppose in the last two seasons for myself, Percy, I know my role is okay. I'm probably going to finish my rugby at London Irish.
Mm-hmm.
My goal now is to. I got my personal goals. Still want to perform. Still want to play the best I can. But long term, I want to leave this club as best I can and develop these academy boys who are sort of breaking through and making them feel at home and sort of a blank canvas for their future at the club and you know, go on to bigger, better things with the club as well.
Does it give the team a different social feel? Because obviously they're all a bit older, they've all got a bit more money, they're all probably married with kids, that kind of thing.
I think COVID itself sort of definitely
taking
its toll on the social environment. You know, like, I can't remember what it's like to have a social life.
Do you know what? COVID, that's a great point.
Yeah, so, like, as far as that's sort of taking care of that issue anyway, but, you know, there's still the old school. We still have the old school court sessions. And I think, as far as I remember through my career, there's always been a handful, at least sort of, you know, anywhere from 5 to 8 proper old boys that, you know, are your senior members and sort of still run the cutter in that. And I think that's always how it's going to be because I'm still learning now. So I look at, sort of, you know, myself 7 years ago, I'm like, man, I was pretty rookie then when I thought I'd known it all. And these little bits, you know, sort of like the dark arts of the game, I can still help with the boys to develop.
Mm. Now, just reading a bit about you before we came online, I was just basically looking through your rugby history. And prior to Worcester, it's fairly hard to get much about yourself. So what were you doing before you came over to the UK?
I was partying heaps, that's for sure. Yeah. I was like, rugby was never a realistic goal for... Look, I always played rep rugby growing up, but in New Zealand, that's what you do, you know? Like, if you got sort of, you make your reps, and I played Wellington age grades. And then after school, first 15, I left school early, and I went to Australia, and I just had a great time, and I just...
Oh, right.
I went to the Gold Coast with my best mate, and I just laboured for a year, and we partied, and I got to surf, you know, most days, and... just loved it. It was your first taste of freedom, right? You're sort of 17, 18, and you finally leave the nest, and was just had an amazing time there. And I think it was just the partying and stuff was running away a bit far away from me. And my mum at the time said, look, you need to come back and get a trade, or, you know, go to uni or do something. So I was like, yeah, fair enough. So I planned to go home back to New Zealand, and after a year of sort of having fun, and was going to get a trade and then head out to Europe and just travel and just do the OE buzz, and before I sort of settled down later in life. And I went home, and went to the local club to stay fit, and just a bit of pre-season training, didn't plan to play. And we sort of, I mean, this is all amateur stuff, and but the prem amateur is quite decent level, you know. You can get All Blacks playing at any given week. And they said, oh, do you want to play for the prem? So I said, yeah, why not? My dad grew up at this club and played for the prems, and I thought that'd be pretty cool if I could say, you know, be in the same hallway with the photos as my dad. And sort of just loved my rugby that year, just had a great year. It's just a naive sort of, probably had a chip on my shoulder kid, you know, and was just going running around like a madman trying to bang anything or, you know, carry as hard as I can straight. And just, I think the coaches enjoyed that.
And just, so yeah,
we had a historical year with that club. And, you know, that year we had Corey Jane, Abby Mathewson.
What?
Yeah, we had a great club year. And we had these sort of, he was at Leicester for a little while, and he was at Nottingham. Our hooker.
Oh, Duffy.
Duffy, yeah.
Yeah, he was so, immense.
Yeah.
It's not Joe Duffy, is it? Is it Joe Duffy?
Yes, Joe Duffy. Yeah. Yep. And I mean, he's as hearty moldy as you can find, but he's a great boy. After he's had a chopped a few as well, he gets pretty wild. But,
nice.
He was a legend, and he sort of looked after me as well. I was like the young buck, and we had a talented team that year, and there was a lot of guys who were just trying to prove something as well. And we won the Swindale Shield and ended up getting, anyway, I ended up getting picked up for the Hurricanes Academy. But again, I didn't really see that as a serious thing. Didn't think I was going to progress anywhere. I was still enjoying time. All my mates were like surfers and skaters, and they're at uni and just having a great time. So probably overindulged in that. And I just enjoyed playing rugby. I was like, I'll just play rugby and then I'll finish my trade and I'll go to work, you know. But then I had a guy called Chris Sterling. Knew I had a British passport. Was doing some consultancy work with the Cornish Pirates. Sent me a whole bunch of Google images of the surf in Cornwall and said, like, look, you can come here, play rugby and surf. How's that sound to you? I was like, done. So I was just like, yeah, next flight out.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So I've got a lot of questions now. So just a few quick fire ones then. What position was your dad?
The second row. He said he'd cover the back row, but I highly doubt that. He's too slow to be in the back row.
Excellent. And what trade were you going to pick up?
I got a trade in roofing. I was going to do building, but at the time, my best mate was on the tools and he was doing roofing. He said, come work with me. I was like, sweet, okay.
Great.
So I jumped into roofing.
You sound like a man that just says yes to suggestions. Like, do you want to come to the Gold Coast? Yeah, okay. Do you want to do roofing? Yeah, fine, I'll do that. Hurricanes Academy? Yeah, go on then.
It kind of was that. I was at that age, to be fair. It was just like just floating about.
So at what stage in New Zealand rugby do you start picking up some money? I mean, could you live on any money in the Hurricanes Academy? Or was it a case that, hey, I'm going to go away to Cornwall and I'll do some roofing and then hopefully I'll get a bit of money on the side playing rugby?
Yeah, I remember. I don't know what it's like now. I've got no idea with how they do payments these days, but I just know that at one stage, and I didn't get this, there was some boys in the academy, and you had to be on the real fringe of the Wellington sort of Lions. It was like they called it the Wellington 15 or whatever. They were getting like 5,000 NZ a year at that time. And I think you get topped up with bonuses if you play. I think the bonuses might be decent if you play. I know Super, they have minimum wage in Super, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
To be fair. As you know, like I've definitely been part of contracts where I'm starting over boys on, you know, 100,000 more than me and they can't get in the team. And, you know, that's brutal. But in New Zealand, at least they've got a minimum wage, which I think's good. I see some of the academy kids, what they're on over here, and I'm like, it certainly was far off that when I was getting into that.
Yeah.
You know, I might have looked at it differently if I seen that kind of money at that early stages.
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the academy kids coming through now, they're not on big money by any means. I mean, they're really not. But if you give a 18-year-old 20 grand a year, they may as well be a millionaire.
Yeah. I think like my first contract wasn't far off that, you know, and I was wrapped with that.
Yeah.
I was like, and I was playing week in, week out, you know. They're definitely, you know, getting a pound of flesh out of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the academy boys now are going to be getting even more money than before. Because it's, well, at least it's my theory that as the salary cap comes down, all the internationals will have to be paid more because they need to stay in this country, and also the RFU are going to top up their wages. So all of those middle ranking players or internationals from other countries or you know, good solid club players, they're going to get squeezed, and I think the money is going to go to the academies to fill out the teams because the rest of the money is going to go to the internationals. Is how I feel it'll probably go.
That's certainly getting a feel for that. We definitely took a hit on some great players who were far above the academy, but probably not classed as that sort of, you know, premiership starting or potential international. And, you know, rightly or wrongly, they got their tag. And I think, and some of them have proved people wrong.
Yeah.
Like Scott Steele's gone on, he's now started last week in a blinder against Italy. And you know, he unfortunately got let go from our club, and he was loved at our club. And that seems to be the trend, which is really unfortunate because there's some quality people and quality players that have always been undervalued in their careers.
Yeah, I think there's going to be certain players who are 5% off making massive money. But because they're 5% off, they'll always be on those sort of, you know, middling contracts, or, well, they will disappear now. So, like, lower contracts. There's going to be a lot of competitions, what I'm trying to say, at the lower end of the market in the Premiership.
And it's kind of been that way a long time. But like you say, that 5%, you know, that 5% in performance can be the 200,000 difference,
yeah,
on pay packets, you know. And that's just a savage part of the game. And unfortunately, that's where the cookie crumbles. And trust me, I've been on the bad side of that for many years, you know, coming through and, you know, really having to earn my spot. And a lot of people get these big contracts also just through timing.
Yes.
Through timing, and they might come off the back of like 3 or 4 games. All of a sudden, they're looking unbelievable. They get signed because the team's desperate and these guys just happen to be available. Next thing you know, they're not what they were worth, you know, and this, they're locked into 2 or 3 year contracts. And that's another savage side of, if you're the guy in the middle there who's been working their ass off.
Because,
you know, like, it's just part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I always wonder, and listeners will be sick of me saying this, I just always wonder why props don't learn to play hooker or both sides of scrum, purely for that reason, like you say. Timing is everything. It might just be that timing when they're desperate, where you can leverage that extra, you know, 10 or 20K on onto a contract.
You've definitely got some weight to that sort of thought, but yeah, it's kind of, you're either average at 2 positions and you'll get an average wage, or you're specialist and you're the man at 1 and you're going to get that pay packet for that position. It's kind of, you know, that's where I'll see that for sure. I know a lot of guys get stuck in that, which position are you, and then that kind of ends up being a negative effect on them. You get that in the back row as well sometimes, you know, or the old second row 6, they don't know which one you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes that can sort of, you can have a struggle in that department.
Now, I don't know, I'm trying to work out how to ask this question or say this thing without inadvertently causing offence, I guess. But I guess a sign of how good you are as a rugby player is the fact that you start at 7 regularly. But 7 is probably, this is the bit which is difficult to say. 7 is probably the easiest place to play, which makes it the hardest place to play, because there's so much competition for 7 shirts, if that makes any sense. You don't have to be unnaturally wide or strong or tall or fast, but you have to be really, really good.
Yeah, To be fair, I was an eight. I signed as an eight over here. I came over. It was a lot bigger, a lot bigger. So I played eight. But I always sort of had that natural, wanted to be in everything part of my game.
Yeah.
I didn't have enough patience to wait for my opportunities to carry or make tackles or turnovers. It was was quite often just chasing work. And it was Glenn Delaney that brought me in and said, look, you're a seven. We want to basically train you as a seven. And so when I signed with Irish, before that I was an eight, and then I signed here as a seven. But yeah, I think back in the sevens, this position that's just evolved. It's gone from back in my day, you flew into a lot, but you'd have your so you sweep a seven roll.
Yeah,
you'd go behind the D line and you used to sweep in and steal the ball, and that was your sort of your sole part of your job was the jackal. And then it developed into, you know, you had more, you're part of the breakout plays with the backs. And now you look at the sevens, and they're the six sevens, you know, they're big boys, and they're buckling people like Curry and Underhills and
big lads, aren't they?
You know, like that's where that position is now. It's the Frenchies and the South Africans have been doing it for years, having left and right rather than 6-7. And I think that's where the rest of the world, other than your specialists like Hooper, Artie plays across the back row.
Yeah, he does.
You know, other than a few exceptions of the guys that are sort of that smaller mold, it certainly seems to be what Eddie Jones is looking for, is your taller, sort of more powerful sevens that sort of fit the six mold. So a game is just that seven's always been that sort of evolving position, and it seems to continue that as well. But and answering your question, I think in the Prem in top flight, you're always working your ass off to save your position, and you got to perform week in, week out, and bring a point of difference to hold that jersey, especially in seven.
Yeah, just on the seven thing, I think you raised some really interesting points there, because these are some things which I've been thinking about. You are right that we play sevens, you know, like the traditional UK seven bolts onto the side of a scrum. But why? I guess it's because we've always done that. But then you look at Exeter, and then Exeter have done this thing when they've got two enormous men like a Dave Ewers or a, I think his name now, the other enormous Zimbabwean that they have.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Whose name escapes me now? Don Armand. There you go. And then it seems that you know, that makes more sense for them scrummaging going forward. So they stick a traditional seven in at eight, and I quite like that. I quite like that approach of setting up your scrum and how to utilise seven skills, but in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's been, it's horses for courses as well. What style your team plays and what you want from your players. Where you attack the game the most, and that's going to be where you bring in your, if you're just going to be big ball carriers and you want to win the physical battle and you're not going to shift the ball that much, or you're not too worried about jacklers at the breakdown, then you can have those big bulky players that are just going to, you know, bring that extra physicality. But then they run sort of Sam Simmons at eight, and I really see him in the sort of Artie Salvier kind of mold.
Yeah.
He can just do everything. And the only thing he lacks in is probably, although he did jump in the line out a lot against us, but that's probably where he's probably regarded as weakness would be the line out option from an eight's perspective. But I look at the game a lot differently since I've sort of dived into the more the S&C side of things and just see what proper athletes are and what real power is. because sometimes size can be smoke and mirrors, you know.
Yeah.
And I think Sam Simmons certainly, you know, brings that to light.
Oh, the power of the boys. I mean, like, his acceleration. I was lucky enough to watch him in the AJ Bell the other week. And he just goes around the blind side of a mall, which is set up from a line out. He's lightning, absolutely lightning.
And I mean, look at Darcy Graham. He's probably what? I think he might be 90 kgs wet. But
yeah.
What he does, you know, what he does with his power and that, he can catch boys off and he can hit boys in the tackle. And the other ones you got to watch out for.
Yeah. And so just fill in the blanks for me here then. You were at Cornish Pirates. I take it you had a few seasons there. And was that then straight to Worcester? Did you encounter Worcester when they were in the Premiership? Sorry, in the Championship, or did you go from the Championship up to the Premiership with Worcester?
They were in the Championship.
Yeah.
When I was there, so was London Welsh, so was Newcastle.
Were they, what? Really? Were they all?
Yeah, I was there for 3 years. So it was London. London Welsh was definitely there.
Yeah.
Worcester was definitely there. And seasons, but it was across 3 years. I went halfway through a season. I left halfway through a season.
Okay.
So it was Newcastle, London Welsh, and maybe Worcester. Maybe twice. I can't remember.
Was it Bristol?
But
yeah.
It was Bristol.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. My very first half season was actually Exeter. They went up that year.
Ah, really? So who was your coach there? It wasn't Richard Hill.
When I went to Worcester, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I went to Worcester, it was Richard Hill. Who else was there at the time? Phil Larder used to do our defense.
Oh, really? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. His meetings were pretty intense. He'd come in he'd do like 2 days a week. But it was definitely like one of those old school approaches, like I was saying, the fear factor.
Yeah.
Everyone made sure they had their notebooks, everyone would be writing things. And we'd have the old school gauntlet to make sure that, you know, the shoulders were sharpened. And but yeah, I was at Pirates. I loved it there. And I got offered contracts to other premiership clubs prior to that because I was playing well at Cornish Pirates at the time. But we were looking to develop that sort of Exeter vibe, and we'd been promised the stadium was going to get built, and that fell through twice. So it was sort of like getting to that stage. Like, look, I want to stay, but I've got to take the next opportunity. And they had an injury crisis halfway through the year, and yeah, I went up and joined them halfway through the season. Started every game and it was great. And then the following season, I couldn't buy a start, you know.
Really? So you were talking about old school coaches before. I don't know how true this is, but hopefully you will tell me. Richard Hill is meant to be an incredibly old school coach.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting for sure. that's sort of as diplomatic as I can be. it was definitely old school. I remember getting to, you know, you come from the Championship and you come from sort of like amateur rugby and you turn up to Worcester, amazing facilities, and, you know, they've got all the S&C gear, you do all your testing, you know, your piss pots, and they do all your monitoring, and it's like, this is some flash stuff, and then you go out to their training paddock and puts you in a line and he tells the boys, right, boys, I want you to go around the perimeter of the field. First man at the front of the line, over your head. Next man under, over till it gets to the back.
Wow.
That guy runs around the front. You do it. And I'm going, Andy Goode at the time, he's in hysterics going, what is this? And I'm in stitches going, oh, man, I thought I came, like, you know, I thought I'd cracked it and come to a prim club.
Yeah.
We're doing over under. And we're just pissing ourselves.
That's phenomenal. So there's quite a good story out of Leicester when they got rid of Dean Richards. They replaced him with, do you remember Marcelo? I want to say Marcelo Lafreda. If I've got that guy wrong, I apologise to whoever Marcelo Lafreda is. But he was the coach that got Argentina to the World Cup semi. Remember him back in the day?
Maybe.
So they replaced Dean Richards with Marcelo Lafreda, you know, and Leicester being Leicester, winning everything in sight except for that, you know, a few seasons. And apparently just came there and started making the boys run Canterbury Squares over and over again. And I thought, this can't be a real thing.
The old Four Corners trailer. Just taking it back to humble beginnings, is it?
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah,
but I mean, it seems that things picked up for you quite nicely then, because if you're having Glenn Delaney as a coach later on as a player, you're doing okay.
Yeah, I'd probably put my big break down to Glenn Delaney. He was coaching Nottingham while I was at the Pirates, and two of my best games actually were against Nottingham while I was at the Pirates, and I was really struggling to find a contract. I was out of contract. Worcester didn't want me. Like a flick of a switch, I wasn't what Richard Hill was looking for, and you know, that's fine. That's what happens. Mm. thought I had locked in something with Cardiff Blues. That fell through. We were all but signing the main contract. And they said, oh, no, because I wasn't a big enough name to take up a foreign spot, mm-hmm. not being Welsh and all. And then, Glenn Delaney said, do you want to come meet for a sit-down with himself and Brian Smith?
Yeah.
And, signed a three-year deal and
had
a lot to prove at that stage. Yeah. It wasn't good money by any means, but it was security at that time, you know. I had nothing. And so... Yeah, within my first year, I got capped as well, and we managed to extend the following year to a proper contract for another 3 years, which I was happy with.
So you're an eight at the moment, okay? So I find this is the boring stuff that I find incredibly, incredibly interesting, right? You're an eight, and Glenn Delaney's seen you as a potential seven. That's broadly speaking what it was. Were you playing seven at Worcester, or?
No, I think I might have played six once or twice. We had like Matt Kubisic and we had Jack Abbott.
Okay.
We're like proper, your proper sort of mold of a seven.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no real need for me to play seven. Oh, and Sam Beattie would cover seven as well.
So this is my biggest bugbear in rugby, which are coaches offering players 2 year contracts. Because, like, take your example, okay? Someone's seen something in you and they think, okay, brilliant. If we get this guy on not big money, but we can get him in and he can only take a 2 year contract, we win. But actually they lose, because if they're right and you're any good and you're on small money, by year two, you're going to want a massive pay rise. So actually the ball's in your court. You've got all the power. What they did by saying, sign a 3 year right now, and when we're ready, we'll give you the pay rise. Much, much smarter. I don't understand why anyone offers these two-year deals. They're an absolute nightmare.
I think that, you know, three-year deals also come with injury. But if you in your first year, you've got a massive injury and then you don't come back from that injury,
that's fair.
You know, you're running the risk of that. And just the harsh reality of our game is... no one's, you know, susceptible to an injury, and certainly not a serious one. But yeah, I agree, and it seems to be the way forward these days.
Yeah,
because like we were speaking earlier about creating a longevity with your squad and your environment, you need the core of your team for the future locked in for a long period. And I think people are starting to understand that. And I'm seeing, Hamish Watson just signed a crazy years, I think.
Has he really? I wasn't aware of that.
I think I could be really wrong here, but I know it was 5 years at least.
Wow.
Yeah. So, these guys are locking in their futures, you know. Like, I know Jamie Ritchie did the same thing as well.
Mm.
But we're signing boys on 3 years for sure, especially the youngsters. And I think that for the future, I think that's the way you get your squad for a long period, and you can plan around that as well.
I completely agree. And if they're worth more, and you think they're worth more, offer them a slight pay rise and but extend their contract. So it's just one of those things which bugs me when I hear about the 2 year contract and coaches saying go back yourself, because they overpay in the first year, sorry, they underpay in the first year and overpay in the second year. So anyway, that's just a thought I had on that. Now, with Cardiff Blues, you said that because you weren't Welsh, you couldn't sign there. Did you know that you were Scottish at this point?
I ran a Scottish passport.
Okay.
Yeah, so I got my Scottish passport, and that's I used to always, my mum's like full-blown Scots, like
with you.
She was born and raised there, yeah. And so it was never like, it was always this pipe dream, especially still until like up until I signed with Irish, you know.
Uh-huh. So two questions there. When you were looking for a contract, did you contact the Scottish clubs? Because that would be obviously the first port of call for myself in that situation. But the second question is, when did you receive a call from Scotland that they were interested, letting you know?
So you've got your agents and they do all that kind of hunting out, and they certainly would have dropped that into the club saying like, but like I really was a no name at this period, you know. I probably just looked like some sort of random battler picking up what he could, you know, on small cash and being like third string of the Prem Club, you know. But again, it was Glenn Delaney and Brian Smith who they obviously seen something in me and had faith and true potential and thought I could go in Scotland. But we had a guy come through London Irish at the time. His name was Kieran Lowe, and he was a talented athlete and he was a talented rugby player and he was still really young. And he was Scottish qualified, and you know, he was more what Scotland were interested in, was a young prop. He was a big boy and he was fast and he was powerful. And they said, look, you know, this kid, if you snap him up now, you know, you might get him before England. So it was at the time Scott Johnson come down and have a sit down with, because Scott Johnson knew Brian Smith, and obviously Scott Johnson was running the cutter up at Scotland. And Smithy told him about him. So he's come down from Scotland. At the time. And Brian Smith goes, oh, we've actually got another guy here. He's Scottish qualified. He might want to, you know, we think he's got the goods. And I'd injured myself that preseason. And I was, you know, the A-League, I was like having my first game run out and getting back to match fitness was in the A-League, and it was the night they came down on the Monday and I was playing Monday night. So they watched me out there and I was so determined to prove myself in that game for London Irish. I had no idea that the Scotland coaches were watching. And I just went berserk that game. Loved it. It was pretty good because, you know, I think I put up a midfield bomb. I think I was doing all sorts of random stuff, but just trying to, on top of that, I was just flying around trying to hit anything. But they sort of enjoyed my energy and they said, oh, look, you know, we can't promise you anything, but we'll keep an eye out on you. And they sort of got the ball rolling.
That's amazing. And there's a sort of moral to that story, which is you never know who is watching.
You never know. And I'll always say this, rugby is a small community. So one, like, you know, at any time someone can be watching you or take interest that you've no idea about. And two, don't burn bridges.
Yes.
One of my biggest lessons was like, just don't burn bridges.
Do you know what? I should learn that lesson. I think that would be very valuable if I actually took heed of those words.
I just look at some of the things that happened over my career. Had I approached them differently, I might not have got the opportunities like 3-4 years down the line.
Yeah.
Because I made good relationship with Glenn Delaney early doors in the championship, and we always spoke and we got on well. And, you know, in the end, that was the way I got into achieving the things that I did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I absolutely love Glenn because he wrote the lineouts for my local club. So, you'll never hear a bad word about Glenn Delaney here. That is for sure.
Nah, he's a legend, and everywhere he goes, he definitely, you get the same feedback from anyone that's been involved with Glenn. You know, they love him to bits, and he's so good at man management.
Mm. What do you put your longevity down to as a player, Blair?
I think you know, touch wood, I've been really lucky with my body. Don't get me wrong, it's had its tough times and fair share of injuries, but managed to avoid, you know, continuous long-term injuries. But I can't explain it. I'm still hungry and still so excited whenever I touch the rugby field, whether it's training or playing. I have my tired moments at training. Body definitely feels a bit more fatigued, but majority of the time I'm excited to be out there, and I still have that hunger and excitement you did as a kid when you take the field. I'm a bit smarter with it, and I can control it better. And but I think that's been my main drive. I just still love what I do, and I still genuinely want to go play rugby and have that love to play. I think a lot of people, when that fades out, that's when they call it. And I certainly feel that way with me. If that sort of fades out and I don't have those feelings and I'm not emotionally attached, you know, I won't perform.
Do you think that's got anything to do with the fact that you weren't an academy guy? You weren't wearing the, you know, England or, sorry, in your case, New Zealand under 20 shirt. It wasn't, because I do feel now that young lads coming through the club system, although they're very lucky to have all the support and infrastructure which is put around them, it is overbearing, and I think they can get jaded by rugby. And you think about, you know, where you've come from, and also your relegations too. When you find yourself back in the Premiership, surrounded by people like Sean O'Brien and whoever else it may be, I guess that would still be quite exciting.
It's certainly to while I'm still here, because I do appreciate what I've got. Potentially a hell of a lot more than the boys that were gifted at a young age and stuff. I've had to earn, this isn't a sob story, because I probably created the hard work that I had to do to get here, probably by being a bit sloppy when I was younger. But once I realised what I wanted, I had to work hard to get back those years that I probably, you know, either partied away or didn't do my, you know, due diligence through my early academy years. I had to work hard to catch up to those, and now I appreciate it a lot more. And and look, I worked hard as a roofer, tradesman, pipe layer, and I look at what I'm doing now, I love this like 1,000 times more than I loved any other job I ever had. And you know, the longer I can hold on to it, the better. So that probably certainly plays into it as well.
And I think this sort of does play into the way that your style as a player too. Because I notice that you do all the back row stuff, but on occasions, and I've wanted to ask you this for quite a long time, do you feel that sometimes you take on too much responsibility on the rugby field? And I'll give you an example. I was watching you the other week, and you were, I think, you guys won. But what struck me is how often you had an intervention in the game. From just being back row stuff to, you know, being the nine to whatever it may be.
Definitely, there's definitely like over my years, coaches have been like, you know, you just got to breathe out there sometimes. Like, you know, you got to take a few actions off and be more effective and, you know, in the ones you are involved in. But it's just who I am. It's just how I play. It's just how I see the game. You know, I can't, if I don't play like that, it's just not me. And sometimes I wish I didn't, maybe wasn't so energetic or so, you know, so absorbed in the game. But it's just who I am, and it's just how I play the game, and it's who I've always been. So it's really hard to explain, and I've definitely had those conversations with coaches, and I've got better at it. But on the other hand, I think that's just always who I will be.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, because, I mean, quite a lot of coaches are very formulaic. And the reason they're formulaic is because they need to add value to the team. And how do you prove you're adding value to the team? Well, look, here's a coaching system which I came up with, and player X does, you know, roles A, B and C. And then you get a player who's incredibly enthusiastic. And actually, when you go over your workload, it often creates problems. Well, not problems, but it's just not what they had in mind.
Yeah, I'd also say, like, a lot of it looks like I'm doing, but I do see the game. Mm. And, if I, like, it's not me just going there for the sake of going there because I can be. I will see, and sometimes I can see, I'll see ahead of the game. And like you say, it can have a knock-on effect if someone sees me filling a role that they probably should have done. That might then throw things out of whack in your structure or whatever, and understand that sometimes I've got to be better at that.
Yeah.
But I think that's where I've probably been lucky. I feel I do have a natural instinct for the game, and I can see things, and that's how I get to certain spots as well.
Well, I wouldn't. Yeah, it's not one of those things. Which, you know, it's not like. I just think it must be tricky for coaches, because like, if you look at Justin Tipperick, I'm not entirely sure how you build a system to put him inside of it, because you don't know how he's going to see the game, if that makes sense.
He's just a clever footballer as well.
Yeah.
You know, you just, as a coach, you always give them a blueprint, your team a blueprint, but at the end of the day, you've got to play what's in front of you. And a lot of the times you'll have, if you find yourself out of that blueprint or that, or your game plan, there's always ways that you can, like, okay, I've gone a bit far here. I'm not on my channel. I'm not in my pod. You're clever enough to work yourself back into that, because that's just rugby and comes with experience. And certainly with Tipperick, he knows where his moments are. I think there's probably a lot more sort of calculated moves by him and probably the coaches than it probably looks. But and that's because he's just a great footballer and can break through tackles and being good spots.
Excellent. Well, before we wrap it up then, just give me your thoughts on this London Irish team which you find yourself in now. I mean, I can't work you guys out. Sometimes you're knocking on the door for top four, other times not quite so much. Whereabouts are you, and what do you think needs to occur for you to make top four? Do you think you can make top four this year?
Oh, going off our top performances, yeah, we could, but consistency is key in everything in life, but it certainly is in professional sport. As an individual point and as a squad point. And we are taking steps, and it can sometimes be a case, two steps forward, one step back, but at least we're still going forward. And like for us, that it's sometimes we don't take our learnings quick enough, or we don't, you know, or we'll take learning from 1 week. We go next week, we fix that learning, but the learning that we took from 2 weeks ago, we've forgotten, and yeah. Then that has a knock-on effect for that performance. So there's a lot of maturity that still has to be developed in our game. But everyone's so hungry to solve this and to get to a point where we are consistent in our performances. It's just going to take a little bit more time. And we've got the player pool now, and unfortunately we've got a few injuries as well in key spots that has an effect on our performances as well. So once we're fully fit and our squad's fully match fit, I think you'll see more consistency on the back of that, and we'll also mature a lot quicker when that experience is around the younger boys as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting to say that, because you know, particularly with London Irish squad profile, having so many experienced guys, even though they're individually experienced, it's getting that cohesion as a team, I guess, which is the real difficult part.
And Shawnee's had a run where he's been in and out, and Ed's Coleman, he's now out with some injuries, and you know, it's one thing these guys being able to talk to players, but it's a different killer fish when they're actually on the field there with them and creating those relationships and actually showing them, showing boys, you know, that they're very good at speaking at meetings and whatnot, but it's so much more powerful when they're out there and they're doing it with them. So when we have that, you know, again, it'll be a great step in the right direction. It's really hard for us to talk about top four, you know. We haven't earned that right to talk about that. We're performance-based at the moment, talking one game at a time. I think there's maybe two teams that can set those goals, which is Exeter, who deserves to set those goals after years of being there. And I think Bristol have developed, for sure, the right to talk about top four. I think Quinn's is heading that way, but such a
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think one team is. I think Exeter have the right to say, yeah, we're top four. Everyone else, as far as I'm concerned, need to prove it. I can't remember the last time Quinns... I mean, Quinns look great. I'm really excited by Quinns. Yeah. I think Sale are very powerful. Well, you found out that Sale are very powerful last weekend, I guess. Or was it weekend before last?
I'm kind of meaning that more on their points. Yeah, like,
but like they're
If you talk at the start of the season, sending your goals out, they're the only people that, you know, they're the only... If right now, if you were to talk realistically, you know, Bristol can talk about being in the top four. Because
they've
got the points, you know, and it'd take a lot for them not to be in the top four from now to the end of the season. I've seen crazier things happen, but I very much doubt that they're not going to be there. And Quinns are now starting to be pretty solid in the top four, so maybe they could start having those conversations as well on current points and current form. But for sure, you go to the start of the season, there's one team that can set that goal, and they've earned that, and that's Exeter.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, it's Quinns, Bristol, this weekend, so I'll be fascinated to see how that goes, because Quinns have, well, I think they've benefited, haven't they?
Friday?
It's Saturday, Quinns Bristol. Yeah, so
it will be a good watch. I'll record that one.
Yeah, because they, because obviously Quinns have had a very settled team, haven't they? They've not lost anyone really to internationals, and Bristol can seem to put any 15 guys in those jerseys, and they look great. So I don't know what's going to happen, but very, very much looking forward to that one, because I'm a bit of a Norse, so.
I think Quinns is definitely, like I say, about that whole restructuring of the coaching situation and bringing that, you know, having that shelf life of everyone reacts well to it, you know. So it seemed to work when there's sort of a changing of the guard as far as the coaches. They seem to be playing different for sure.
One just strikes me as a complete culture clash. It just strikes me as a guy has come in there who was a very good coach in his own right, but the situation, the time and the place just didn't suit the skills that he had. And, you know, it's not really an indictment on him. He'll move on and be successful elsewhere. But, you know, Quinns are better for him not being there, which is a weird thing to say. So addition by subtraction.
Yeah, for sure. Because, look, I haven't worked with him, but I've met him and come across him. He seems like a top guy. And whenever I spoke rugby with him, he certainly seems to know what he's on about. But like you say, yeah, culture clash, like, and it can be as simple as that. You can have a coach with all the skills in the world, but it just wouldn't work with certain people, and you put them in a complete different environment that's, you know, more catered to them, and they'll take them to the top four, potentially win premierships, you know.
Yeah. Well, Blair, thank you so much. I've kept you for longer than I said that I would. We're just over an hour now.
All right.
Before you go, give me a prediction for where you think London Irish will finish this year. And are you on social media? Can we find you, or are you wise enough to stay away from it?
I'm not the most interactive on it, but I have my sort of photography page on Instagram. It's BC_edits_UK.
Oh, awesome.
Or you can find me on Twitter.
Brilliant.
Yeah, well, I'm probably pretty boring for most viewers and listeners. I'm not too indirect on it. Quite a lot of cheesy baby photos on there these days.
Well, I don't know about that. Photographer, surfer, seven, international, rugby player, Blair Cowan. So thank you very, very much. And hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Excellent. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.